As I said, my name's Alan Stilk. I started the estate and trust group at Stark & Stark, and I head up our business law group. So I'm going to be speaking to you tonight about protecting your family and estate planning. With me is Rose Durkin, who's of counsel at our firm. Rose spends all of her time dealing with estate and trust issues. So as we have questions, again, just tell us, just ask us your questions as we're going along. Either I'll answer it, or if I don't know the answer, we'll have Rose answer it. And certainly, as we go through this, there may be times I'll call on Rose to maybe discuss in length a little bit more than we have up here. The presentation is in your handout, as I understand. And also in the handout is a little document for you. It's a last will and testament. You never got one?
No.
How many don't have any of... How many? Just two? I will go get those. Well, what I'd like you to do first, even before we start, is take a look at the last will and testament that we prepared for you. And really what that document is a document that tells you what your estate, how your estate will be administered and your assets distributed if you don't have a will. In other words, this really follows the intestate statute. This tells you what happens if you don't have a will. And you can read through it. I think it's sort of self-explanatory. But you can understand that this is the last thing you want to have happen. And again, it's the situation that probably most of the people in this state, and I don't know how many people in this room, face, because they haven't taken the time to make a last will and testament out for themselves. Not a very difficult document to do if we're making some very simplistic things, but certainly we can change what has occurred in the document you're holding. So let's go through the presentation. Protecting your family and estate planning. Last will and testament is, again, we have one more person coming. We discussed with you the fact that if you haven't done this, the document you're holding is going to really distribute the assets that you have. But what are we talking about with the last will and testament? Well, definitions. First of all, it's going to determine who is to receive your property at death. If you take a look at the document that you have, it's probably not going to be exactly as you would like to have happen. Certainly, there's a lot of different circumstances that the legislature tries to deal with, because they're second-guessing what they think you would want to do if you didn't take the time to make the will. It designates who's going to be your executor and guardian and trustee. That's what's going to be in your last will and testament. Now, the trustee may not necessarily just be in the will. Many times when we're doing planning, we will have separate trust agreements. The executor. Again, this is a little, I'll call this estate planning 101. That's someone who's going to file the will with the service court in the county, which in fact you die within, pays final bills and taxes, and distributes the remaining property to your beneficiaries. Guardian. If any of you have minor children, you have the opportunity to in fact appoint a guardian in your will. If you have children who have minors, you may want to impress upon them to take a look at putting these positions in. And again, if you take a look at that last will and testament, it tells you what happens if you don't take the time and effort to name guardians. Trustee. Again, there can be trust within a will. More likely than not, we would not have the trust within the will. But a trustee is a person or a group of people who holds property for the beneficiaries who may be a minor, who may be disabled. And again, if you want to do some sophisticated planning, it could be in perpetuity for the lives of many generations of your family. What happens without a will? The document we gave you. I mean, it's self-explanatory. It'll tell you what happens without a will. But let's talk a little bit about some of the major downfalls. And Rose, I don't know if you have a document there. In fact, Rose was the author of this document. But some of the problems that we run into where people die intestate without a will may even be the very simplistic thing. Forget about how the assets are going. let's talk about what happens if you die without a will, and who's going to be the quote-unquote executor or administrator of the estate. What happens there? I mean, what are you faced with when, in fact, someone comes in without a will?
Usually our first question is, we have to figure out who the members of their family, who their closest next of kin are, and those are the people who have the first right to go to the surrogate and apply to be the administrator. Let's say we have a single person who has three brothers and a sister still living. Those are the next of kin. The guy doesn't have any children or anything like that. Maybe he's got a brother he hasn't spoken to in 30 years, but guess what? He's got the same equal right with the other siblings. So that's one reason, you know, it's a lot easier to have a will in that situation so that you can choose, you know, my sister's the responsible one, she'll take care of things. You know, brother Jimmy, you know, he's sort of responsible, he can be number two. Ralph better not be near anything else that I own.
And what happens if they can't agree as to who's going to serve?
Basically then the surrogate's court will pick someone, and the surrogate won't necessarily pick anybody in the family, they'll probably pick an attorney, you know, who works with the court.
Can you pick more than one executive?
You can't. Sometimes clients, let's say if they have two kids, they don't want to make a choice between the two of them. Some clients figure they can share the burden, you know, figure one's here, closer in town, maybe do more of the running around. One to keep an eye on the other one, you know, all sorts of reasons. Usually the reason I probably get the most is just I got two kids, I can't make a choice.
But more likely than not, we're only going to have one executive at a time. Yes?
I have a will from another estate that we buy in New Jersey.
If it was executed validly in that state, yes. The only kind of little pitfall is what New Jersey requires is that if the will is not notarized as well as two witnesses, then you have to track down the witnesses to fill out an affidavit, which depending on distance, you know, and how old the will is, can be a little bit of a problem. But, you know, the general rule is yes, it's still valid, but we might have to track down witnesses.
We would recommend that you either, if you're happy with the provisions of the will, just resign it here with whatever we have. Or quite frankly, it's not that difficult to prepare another will with the same provisions if you're happy with them. All right, so what is included in your estate? Only property in your sole name. So what is not included? Property that's jointly owned with the right of survivorship. And the typical types of thing that we see with that is real estate, your personal residence. If it's owned by a husband and wife, it's generally owned jointly with the right of survivorship. So that deed is going to really determine where the house goes, not necessarily the will. Now, certainly when the survivor passes away, he or she would then look to their will to determine where that goes. But the other things are many people like to hold their assets jointly, like bank accounts. So those bank accounts will, in fact, provide or a contract. And it says if there's survivorship, fine. If it's owned by an individual without that right, then certainly it'll go through by the will. Life insurance is generally, you're naming a named beneficiary in life insurance. Merely because you state in your will where you want it to go isn't going to help you, because the insurance company has entered into a contract with you to pay those policy proceeds to whoever's named in the beneficiary designation. Same is true of annuities, pensions, and retirement funds. If any of you are, in fact, sitting on pension or retirement funds, you have, I'm sure, a beneficiary designation provision somewhere in the line. So those items don't necessarily go through your will unless the beneficiary would have been your estate. Property transferred in the name of a trust during your lifetime. I don't know how many of you have either gone to seminars or actually drafted what we call living trusts that are effective now that you put assets in. Many people do that because they're fearful of handling their own assets at a later stage in their life, and I'd like to name who the trustees are now. Some people are fearful of probate. Some people would like to have anonymity with regards to what they did with their assets, because the will is a public document. A trust generally is not. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why people would use a trust during their lifetime, and that would not go through the will. Estate planning. Now, what we talked about was really doing a document that's going to be different from what the state provides to you in our will-less document that we gave to you. Estate planning is a little different. There is no estate planning, so to speak, by dying intestate, nor is there any estate planning if you leave all of your assets, so let's assume you're a surviving spouse or your children directly. Estate planning is going to come in where we're going to do things indirectly, not directly. But what are we talking about with tax considerations? Well, we have a federal estate tax, and it's imposed on the fair market value of whatever person owns at death, whatever form of that ownership.
What do you mean by the last part? Whatever in the form of ownership?
What we mean is, Alan was mentioning that life insurance goes by beneficiary designation, pension goes by beneficiary designation, bank accounts might be joint survivorship. That is, all of those assets, even though they don't pass under the will, are still subject to federal estate tax.
Really?
Yes.
How about home?
Absolutely. It's reported, okay, on the federal estate tax. If you own it jointly with your spouse, there's a marital deduction, so it's not going to be subject to tax. But depending on how much all of the assets add up to, you're going to have to at least file a return.
We create a bank account that's accepted from your brother. It's subject to tax.
It's subject to estate tax.
All of the balance?
Now, what we have up here is the exemption amount. Okay, the exemption amount for federal purposes this year is $1.5 million. Okay, if everything altogether doesn't add up to $1.5 million, then no, you don't file a federal estate tax return. Okay, but if everything does add up to that amount, okay, then yes, the joint bank account with your brother is going to be one of those assets added in.
Most of the money is gone.
Is what?
Is his, that he contributed to the
right
account.
Right.
You're going to have to prove to the IRS that was the case.
I mean, there's no reason to set yourself up for that kind of investigation later. It's just so much easier just to deal with it and plan with it during your lifetime. Now, is Rose
another
State?
Question.
I'm sorry.
suppose somebody designates something they own, a bond or a CD or something, in trust for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
When that individual dies, is that document or that amount of money in or out of the estate?
It's in the taxable estate, which is what this we're talking about right now, but it is outside the probate estate, so it doesn't pass under the will. It just goes to that beneficiary that's named on the
but
account.
But it is included
it
in the taxable
It will be included
amount
for tax purposes.
Is
yeah
that for the New Jersey taxes?
I'm going to get to that, and that's going to show you.
Okay.
So again, what we have is a climbing amount. In 2006 and through 2008, it goes up to $2 million. 2009, $3,500,000. In 2010, it's the year that everybody's supposed to die and have no estate tax. But see, in 2011, it goes back to $1 million. Now, there's been a lot of discussion. Maybe you've seen things on television, listened to them on radio, read about them in the news, that, in fact, what Bush has done is, taking care of his friends that are wealthy and therefore eliminated a tax that really that money could be used for doing other things. We know that there's a big fight, certainly with the legislature dealing with what should they do here. Should they let it run to $1 million? Should they make an amendment and change it now? Should they wait a little bit while longer? The most recent discussions we've heard is probably coming to a number of about $2.5 million, not to have it unlimited. But who knows in this crazy world what could happen here. And the other thing is, even if it's changed that there's no tax, or even if it's changed to $2.5 million, I've been around so many years to see this thing change over and over and over again. We don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or during our life expectancy. Now, we talked a little bit about the New Jersey inheritance tax. Let me just go through this and you can ask your question. If you're leaving to a spouse or one of your descendants or ancestors, it's no tax. If you're leaving to a brother or sister, there's an 11% tax. If you're leaving to everyone else in the world, there's a 15% tax. And above that, because there was this change in the federal estate tax, which also had an effect on New Jersey getting revenue from the federal government, we have a situation where above $675,000, if you recall, in the prior slides, we talked about $1.5 million and $2.5 million and $3.5 million and then no tax. But anything above $675,000 is going to have a tax imposed for New Jersey at 37%. So Rose, why don't you tell them a little bit what we do in our documents for people who would prefer not to pay any tax at the time of their death?
What we usually can do for a husband and wife is to provide that basically two trusts are created when the first spouse dies. One portion becomes what we happen to call in our documents a family trust, which is going to hold this $675,000 amount, okay? So it's not going to be subject to tax, whether at the federal level or at the state of New Jersey level, because it's below the New Jersey exemption. And, of course, the 675 is below the federal exemption at this point. The other portion of the trust, the other share, is what we call a marital trust. That's not going to be taxed because it's solely going to be held for the surviving spouse, so it qualifies for the marital deduction. The advantage at that point is when both spouses have passed away, we're able to save the 675, not subject to tax, the first spouse. The second spouse still has their 675, so it's $1,350,000 that's passing to the next generation without any tax at the federal level or the state of New Jersey level.
What are some states that are more favorable than New Jersey?
Pennsylvania. Not any. Pennsylvania, their exemption is $1 million. The problem with the difference with Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania also has this inheritance tax, you know, that gets imposed depending on who, you know, you're giving your property to. Pennsylvania has an inheritance tax for children at 4.5%. So that's the disadvantage for Pennsylvania. But the estate tax for PA then starts at about $1 million.
So we can eliminate New Jersey tax, but you can't eliminate going to children
in Pennsylvania.
For their, you know, the transfer inheritance.
What percentage at $1 million? What compares?
It's the 37 again. Okay. Because this is what happened. It's kind of an odd thing, but we actually have to prepare a 2001 federal return as if the person had died 4 years ago to see what the tax would have been back then to figure out what we owe to New Jersey and Pennsylvania now. So it gets it's kind of weird to explain. Yes, sir.
What's included in that value bucket?
The same thing at the federal level. Joint bank accounts, insurance, pension, anything that you have some sort of ownership with.
Including IRAs?
Yep.
That's
correct. The only thing that's exempt for the New Jersey inheritance tax is life insurance. That's why one of the major exemptions. But other than that, for the estate tax, yeah, you add up everything. Yes, sir.
Is there a threshold on the New Jersey inheritance tax, or is it still from $1?
It kind of starts at the 675 at 37.
No, the inheritance tax.
No, the only thing that there's maybe a threat.
You're talking about if it was to a brother or a sister? If you left everything to a brother or a sister?
Like the brother and sister, right.
The brothers and sisters are the only ones that have a minimum, and $25,000 apiece.
And everybody else?
And then once you give your brother $50,000, that second $25,000 is going to be taxed at 11%. But if you only give them 10, then there wouldn't be any tax on what you would.
Could you go over that family trust, the 675 again?
Okay. And this is something we can only do with husband and wife.
Right.
Maybe if the husband I'm going to kill the husband off first. Husband, if the husband just has a will that says, I leave everything to my beloved wife, you know, and then to the children, okay? And he's worth a million and she's worth a million, okay? All right? He's left her another million. So she's worth two now, okay? There's no tax in the husband's estate, okay, because he left everything to a spouse, okay? But now she only has an exemption of $675,000, okay? If we're able at the first death to carve out the $675,000, we've preserved the first spouse's exemption, plus the second spouse still has her $675,000. But we have to do that through a trust document, which the spouse can be the trustee of. It's not as if, you know, we're going to, you know, say, okay, Wachovia Bank or, you know, somebody has to be the trustee. The spouse can still be the person deciding on investments and making disbursements out of the trust. So it's not something you have to go to a trust company to do.
In fact, from planning standpoints, we generally work with trusts. That's really how we're doing our planning. I'm sorry.
I was wondering, is this the same thing that you call living trust or
a living trust is a very general term. What I'm talking about, yes, could be included in a living trust. A living trust is just a trust you have set up during your lifetime. That's really all a living trust means, as opposed to a testamentary trust, which is set up in your last will and testament. Okay? So that's just, those are the two general categories of trust, and then everything else kind of flows from there.
Are you going to cover that with more in detail?
No, not today, otherwise we'd be here for a long time. But again, we're almost always in doing planning using living trusts, but we don't necessarily fund them during your lifetime.
Meaning we don't necessarily put property into the name of the trust. There are many instances where we do, but in general, they usually come into active life when the person dies.
They're not quite living.
Yeah, they're not quite living. You're living when you sign. Yes, sir.
Do you know the rates in New York?
Not off the top of my head, no. I'm afraid I don't.
Are there any states with no tax or intangible?
Florida. Florida has an intangible tax, intangible personal property tax. They do not have an estate or inheritance tax.
But that intangible tax is really getting diminished and supposedly going away sooner or later.
Quick question. Suppose through some mechanism, I get X amount of money. And aside from the inheritance tax and the estate tax, is there any sort of income tax attached to that?
Where income tax can be a problem is with IRA and pension money, okay? So you really want to make sure your beneficiaries, you've looked at the beneficiaries on those. If a spouse is the beneficiary on those type of retirement assets, they can roll it over into another IRA, so they defer the income tax. But if anyone else, child, sibling, if anybody else is going to receive retirement money, yes, besides being subject to an estate inheritance tax, they're going to have to pay the income tax because you hadn't paid it yet. Now, a couple years ago, IRS...
So if they don't roll it over, if they
take only a spouse can roll it over. Everybody else has to start pulling it out. And once you pull it out, you have to pay the income tax.
Yeah, but you don't have to pull out the whole thing.
They only changed that a couple years ago.
So where is it now?
That you can, if it's set up properly, you can the person receiving it, the beneficiary, can actually extend the payments out over their lifetime.
So the income tax would be
so
paid
just get
per year.
Comes out. Right. But, a few years ago, if someone other than a spouse was named as the beneficiary, they had 5 years maybe to pull it out, and that was it. You know, so, I mean, pension money, you know, a lot of us forget about that because we can't spend it, you know, and, you know, a lot of people have big amounts in their pension and retirement funds, and, you know, that can be a problem from an income tax standpoint.
Suppose somebody got an inheritance, presumably as that was earned, income tax was paid.
That's right. If you receive an inheritance, if I left you a bequest of $100,000, you would not pay income tax on that. It's the IRA and retirement money that nobody's paid the income tax yet on it.
But, you know, one of the biggest issues is your decision to leave money, if you're leaving it at all, to children, to the grandchildren. You have the ability to set up trust for these people. that they can't do themselves, to really eliminate tax for them. I mean, many times we'll run into a situation where a successful person will come to us, let's assume that are 45 or 50 years old, to do planning for the two spouses, and they have children. And they've never spoken to their parents about what have they done. And we have kids who are 40 or 50 or whatever that have tax issues themselves that we're working on. And if we could deal with their parents to set up trusts, to leave the money possibly in trust for their children, but then for the grandchildren and great-grandchildren, it would help tremendously. It would set up tax savings.
These would be skipping a generation.
Right. They'd be set up tax savings. You'd have creditor savings. In other words, you'd be able to set up creditor protections. You'd have protections for matrimonial problems. I mean, there's a lot that can be done from what we'll call the grandparents through the children down to the grandchildren. And that's where the communication has to come in. I'm sorry, it's taking so long. Was it your question?
No, it's okay. Do all of these amounts include assets that might hold after the country?
Well, if you are a U.S. citizen or someone who's paying tax here, it's your worldwide assets. Now, there are treaties that may say if you're paying taxes elsewhere in the world, if you die, there may be credits. But in essence, it's your worldwide assets, just like it's your worldwide income. Now, whether or not people ever find out about that, I'm talking about people here in this country, that remains to be seen. I mean, we're sure that there are billions of dollars that have transferred over the lifetimes of generations that have never been taxed here in the U.S. where they should have been. But I can't tell you what's happening now with regards to the scrutiny that the federal government's putting on where people have accounts, how money's coming into this country, and I think they're only going to get better at it as time goes on.
Al,
did you
question
here?
Yes.
The 675 is the net value of the properties after repayment of mortgages and stuff like that. I mean, the house is sold, it's not the gross value of
the house. The 675 is a magic number, is because once the gross value adds up to that, okay, we have to file a return. But mortgages and all those type of things are deductions. So we might have to file a return, but there might not be any cash actually.
So if you had a property worth $700,000 with $100,000 of mortgage on it, you have to file a return but not have to pay the 37% on the excess.
Don't trust for children and grandchildren. You could have trust for somebody who is not there, like a grandchild that you don't have.
Well, yeah, I mean, we set them up that says that if you have that grandchild, if you have that child, if you have that spouse. I'm just saying, you know, generally it's not that way, but we generally deal with grandchildren, the potential for grandchildren or great-grandchildren.
Or afterborn children.
Or afterborn children. Documents take care of that. I better move on. Non-tax considerations. Let's talk about spouses. As Rose had alluded to, there are a lot of tax savings by leaving assets to your spouse. There's a lot of things where we can leave to a spouse and have tax savings. But we run into a lot of situations where we have, this is the second marriage, the third marriage, sometimes the fourth and more. And there are children along the way. So the question is carving out what you want to go to your present spouse. There have been times, but very limited, where it's gone to a past spouse. I'm talking about divorce spouse. But certainly taking into account generally grandchildren or certainly children. So there's a lot of planning that gets involved there. You can't do that with your will-less will here. It's just going to tell you where it's going. Same thing with children. Oh, another factor is this. With a spouse, you may want to leave everything to your spouse, but you'd like to make sure that upon your spouse's death, if he or she survives you, that it goes to your children. So you have the capability of planning for that, as opposed to, if let's assume that I died and my wife remarried, we have two children. Upon her death, if everything went to her, her new husband that she married would have rights to my assets if I gave them to her, unless I set them up properly that they would go to my kids or grandchildren. Same thing with children. As I discussed before, you have situations where you want to make sure, not because the children aren't capable of handling assets, but you certainly don't want to give it to a child who's not really experienced in dealing with things. Maybe they're a minor. You don't want it going to the surrogate's court to be invested in whatever they're investing in now, I guess CDs, and paying probably a bond, which is an expense, where you could put it into a trust that would say that when my child turned 18, they're not getting that asset. They're going to have the absolute use for it during their lifetime, but it's going to grow. It's going to be sheltered from taxes. It's going to be sheltered from their creditors. It's going to be sheltered from matrimonial problems that they may have. And then ultimately, hopefully, it's going to go to my grandchildren if I have them. So there's a lot of planning that can occur with regards to children. Special needs beneficiaries. I just looked, excuse me.
Is there a special term for that spouse, your name is going back to the number one spouse's children?
You're talking about Q-tip? By J&J. special needs beneficiaries. Unfortunately, more and more we're dealing with this. I was going over a trust today. I was talking to my brother. I have a niece who has special needs. We were going through some of the issues of the trust. What you do is you have the opportunity to still have the child who has the special, it doesn't have to be a child, but it could be a nephew, a niece, a friend, it really doesn't matter. That you have a way of not eliminating the benefits they're getting from possibly governmental agencies and still setting up monies for their benefit if they need it. It's an important thing that certainly if you have that situation, you want to talk to an attorney, hopefully us, about those needs. Other relatives and friends, I mean, it's not necessarily true that you're only going to leave money to family members. A lot of people will decide that they would like to leave it to friends or people, other people in need or other relatives other than their children. Their children may not need it. And then, of course, charity. I mean, what's happened is in our country today, the government is spending less and less on certain things that, for instance, look what happened where the Red Cross had to come in and do things with regards to the hurricanes. A lot of people are very charitable-minded. A lot of people, if you'd ask them, they'd rather give money to charities than the federal government to make sure that they've decided where these money is going to be spent. So charities have become a big part of the planning process. Lifetime planning. When someone comes in to talk to us about their estate planning, we're always going to talk to them about preparing the following documents. And Rose, you want to take us through the powers of attorney and things of that nature? You want to click? It's this forward button. It's very complicated.
This one?
Yeah.
A power of attorney is a document that a lot of people really could use during their lifetime. You know, it has nothing to do with, anyone dying or anything. It names a person, an agent, who's going to handle your financial affairs if for some reason you could not do so yourself. Usually people are concerned about, I end up in the hospital, who's going to pay my bills, write my checks out, get the pension check and the Social Security to the bank. Then you can name someone who's going to do that. Those are kind of the usual things people are worried about. But a power of attorney could also include the authority to sell real estate, if there's a business, to handle any sort of business affairs. Sign your income tax returns, make sure they get filed and taxes paid, and to make gifts. Now, usually with making gifts, we limit that to a certain group of people, maybe your spouse and children. But a lot of times, the power of attorney gets to be even more important than the will and trust or whatever.
You want to just come this way? It's probably easier to come through the center.
Sorry.
It's okay.
One of my friends came from out of the state.
Well, we bring them in from all over.
There's up here also, or over there.
But the power of attorney, once a person dies, really the agent has no more authority at that point. So it is really a document that's necessary or extremely useful if there's a possibility of an incapacity, and I mean we. Possibility exists for all of us, whether we're in an auto accident or anything like that. Yes, sir.
But also if you happen to be absent at some time when the document...
Absolutely, it's just, it could be just a matter of you want to take a trip and they've scheduled the real estate closing for when you've already got the cruise tickets. Absolutely. And a power of attorney can be as limited, thank you for mentioning that, it can be as limited or as general as you want. Usually what we're doing is preparing a very general document that, you know, it's here just in case there's a sudden incapacity, but it could be something like you're mentioning, you know, I just want my wife to be able to sign the deed because I can't make it to the closing that we're selling our property. You know, so it can be a very limited document just for a certain transaction, or it can be a very general document. Who should have a power of attorney? Anyone who wants to choose the person who's going to handle those affairs, that you want to have a say in it. As I kind of said at the beginning of the evening, if someone dies without a will, all of a sudden we got all these family members who might have a right to take over. Kind of the same thing happens or can happen if someone becomes incapacitated and there's no one there who can pay the bills or do whatever has to be done. Because the alternative at that point is that the family has to go to the surrogate's court to get a guardian appointed if it's a, you know, a long-term disability. And that can be expensive and time-consuming for the family. So it's a lot better to have a power of attorney up front and in place. Yes, sir?
Does the person who's giving the power of attorney have to know about it?
You usually should at least tell them that you, I would ask them ahead of time, actually, to make sure they're willing to do it. We also would usually suggest that you name one or two people, whether you want to have people serve jointly or whether you want to have people, you know, if my spouse is also disabled, you know, I want son Robert to be next or something like that. But, it's usually better that somebody knows, because if you've had a sudden illness, you know, somebody might need to do something on a fairly, a pretty quick basis. So
the other problem is you may name someone, you may have talked to them about it, and they decline to act. So you never know.
Right, and that's usually why we like to have, you know, a successor, because, you know, you name your best friend and he moves out of state. Yeah.
There was one thing in light of what he said, though, wouldn't the person to elect have to have some documentation also in case that happens, be able to exercise?
They actually take the original power of attorney. They would present it to the bank to say, yes, I can now sign checks on this account, you know, so that their signature's on file with the bank. You know, there's only going to be one power of attorney. They can show it to the bank. They can show it to every bank where the person has an account. You know, the agent has to keep the original.
But beware of bureaucracy. I mean, quite frankly, if you have an account at Merrill Lynch, I'm not naming Merrill Lynch or Wachovia, it behooves you to take a look and see what they have for purposes of a power that will permit another person to come in, because the unfortunate side of that is, what happens when they look at our document, I don't care how plain vanilla it is, you know, you walk into the bank, you're going to deal with the manager. The manager's going to say, oh, I don't know anything about it. It has to go to our legal department. So, I mean, we have found that it's just so much easier to go to the actual financial institution, if you know what's going to be happening, and get those documents signed there. We'll help you fill them out if you need to, but to get them signed there.
But the other side of the coin, which has happened in the situation you and I know about, only the power of attorney was signed at the bank. Well, that only covers the bank accounts at that institution. It's not going to be good enough anywhere else. So you can't, yes, maybe present the general power of attorney to the bank, sign the bank's power of attorney, but don't just sign the bank's power of attorney. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned that you name a power of attorney in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that you can't have
No, I didn't mean to imply that. I just meant maybe that it would not be as convenient for that person, that's all.
Do most brokerage houses have their own power of attorney?
Yes, most of them have their own, but it's only going to cover accounts at that brokerage house. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Did your spouse will not be a power of attorney unless the applicant said
no? No. Now, if you and your spouse have a joint bank account, then yes, the spouse has access to that account or a joint brokerage account. But that isn't going to give the spouse authority, let's say, to sign the deed if the real estate's being sold. You know, you're going to have both signatures on the deed or a power of attorney from one spouse to the other.
So it's not automatically reporting to spouse?
No, it does not automatically. You can name anybody you want. You don't have to name your spouse either.
But I'm saying, if you didn't have it, you know, before about the wife is not considered to be the de facto board.
No. Now, for guardianship, if we got down to a guardianship because there's these documents aren't in place, yes, the court is first going to look to a spouse to be the guardian, you know, and then the court might look to whoever's, you know, the next level of next of kin, maybe children, you know. But, yes, kind of a, for that purpose, you know, but then you're still going through the court procedure and having to prove incapacity and a few other, you know, things. So the spouse isn't, most people will name their spouse, you know, but it isn't an automatic thing. Advanced directives. There are two types of advanced directives that we usually recommend for people. The first one is a healthcare power of attorney. This is a document that names an agent to make a medical decision for you if you, for some reason, could not do so yourself. This is not an end-of-life situation necessarily, okay? This is a situation where, for whatever reason, you cannot communicate with your doctor and make a medical decision. Could be something you're going to recover from, but, you know, there was an auto accident, you're unconscious, somebody's got to give you medical treatment, and the hospital's going to want to talk to somebody to sign the consent order. The living will, which is a separate document, is your statement as to what you wish to happen if it is an end-of-life situation. You know, they aren't necessary. We usually prepare them as two separate documents. The living will, the form we usually use just follows the New Jersey statute, but there are all sorts of things out on the web, and you can really write your own. You know, everybody's, you know, especially after Terry Schiavo, a lot of people have their own opinions on what should happen or shouldn't happen. So that's a very personal statement. But the healthcare power really is, you know, actually naming somebody to make the decision. And that, again, maybe kind of tied into what you were saying, that's not automatically going to be the spouse, okay? Maybe, you know, with the HIPAA regulations that are out there, yeah, your doctor will talk to your spouse. Doesn't have to, okay? Or you might not want your spouse making medical decisions. I know I had a client once whose husband had recovered, fortunately, from a brain aneurysm, and she named one of the kids because she said, you know, Joe will never be able to handle that decision because of what he had been through, okay? So she wanted one of the adult children to do that. So the spouse isn't always, you know, the one, you know, 9 times out of 10, yes, but spouse.
The other thing I just want to mention, this just happened to me a couple weeks ago. I got a call on a weekend from a friend of mine whose 29-year-old daughter was in Atlantic City Hospital, and a decision had to be made, and there was no power. I mean, it just becomes a nightmare, so it's not just about your spouse. It may be about your adult children.
Yes. Do those documents have to be notarized when you fill them out?
The healthcare power of attorney and the living will, the state of New Jersey's requirement is that they are witnessed by two people who are not related to you by blood or marriage and are not your doctor either. So either two witnesses or a notary. That's actually what the New Jersey statute requires. We usually do the whole thing. Well, we have people sign here. But the alternative to not having these two documents is, again, a guardianship. And, I mean, you just mentioned that case in Atlantic City. The last two guardianship cases I handled were two young men who were involved in auto accidents, you know, and have traumatic brain injuries. Well, to do anything, to get them treatment, to, you know, to pursue a lawsuit on their behalf, we have to go through a guardianship. And the gentlemen are, like, 23 and 25, you know. So, I mean, a lot of times these documents, the powers of attorney, the durable power, the health care power, sometimes they get to be almost more important than a will. Any other questions?
You would need these for your children, like a child over 18?
An 18-year-old, anybody over 18 should have these documents in place, I think.
And they're really easy to do,
yeah.
And it's the type of thing that we just don't think about.
Yeah.
I think, is this the end of our formal
yes.
presentation? Let me explain how we work things at Stark & Stark. Irrespective, you're going to have the opportunity to be involved in a drawing for a fabulous gift, which I saw over here.
We like chocolate.
The way that we work it here is, and Rose and I will be here to sign up people if they'd like to come in. We have a free consultation. We will either both of us, one of us will sit with you, go through what your assets are, talk to you about the issues of who should be serving in all of these capacities, talking about planning. We draft an engagement letter that gives you a summary of everything that we discussed, and you owe us nothing unless you decide to sign the engagement letter and retain us. So we'll spend a lot of time with you to come up with a program. We'll tell you what it's going to cost, pretty much, and then the decision's yours as to whether or not you want to come here and deal with them. That's reviewing existing documents as well as people that don't even have documents. So again, we're going to be here. We have our schedule set up to make appointments with people over the next couple of months, and there's no obligation unless you decide at the end to retain us after you get the summary.
We know the standard fees for the evening questions and things like that.
I'm sorry?
Evening questions? You're talking much more evening questions.
Well, as I said, if you were living in a state like Florida, where probate is a big deal, I mean, it's an expensive proposition. Plus, you could probably eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week going to a seminar. you would find a lot of people that have living will, living trusts, and have put their assets into the trust to eliminate probate and for confidentiality purposes. They don't want people knowing what they have. New Jersey is pretty much a probate-friendly state. What we find, it's really individuals who, in fact, are up there in age, really aren't comfortable handling their own assets. They'd like to fund these trusts during their lifetime. They're happy to have a friend or a relative deal with their assets, and they know that if they become incompetent, or if they have to go into a skilled nursing facility, that it's already set up for them and they're not worried.
There's actually a website for people in Florida to go on a website to find out the seminars and what they're serving for dinner.
Okay. I'm going to ask Larry Oring to come up for the second part of this.
Okay, good evening. I'm here to introduce Richard Oring, who's my business partner, and my son. He's going to be talking about the ins and outs of long-term care. Rich and I have an accounting firm, Oring & Company, which has a heavy slant toward financial planning, investments, insurance, and things of that nature. At some point in our history, Richard got involved in dealing with long-term care matters with our clients. Our clients had a unique interest in it, but I think the interest is pretty prevalent at this point. In any event, Rich took it upon himself to gain a certification in long-term care. He did this with a company called the Corporation for Long-Term Care Certification, in which case you go through a rather lengthy process, and they award you finally a designation, which shows that you have the experience and aptitude to do this type of work. After getting that certification, Rich has consulted with several law firms, not to mention financial planning firms, and working with companies such as Allstate, New Century Financial, with their representatives and making proposals to try and satisfy the needs of their clients as well. So with that, I give you Richard Oren.
Good evening. Again, if you have questions during the presentation, just stop me, you can raise your hand, you can just blurt it out, and I'll answer the questions as we go along. And if I forget, at the end of the presentation, Rachel, my assistant, will also be available to schedule appointments, if people, and first meeting is free, you know, first consultation. So tonight, what I want to talk about, what's your plan going to be for living a long life? See, when Franklin D. Roosevelt enacted the Social Security Act in the 1930s, it was intended for people to work till 65, retire, and collect the benefits for 5 or 7 years. But because of modern medicine, we're now enjoying a longer life. Unfortunately, though, we don't know the additional years given to us are going to be good years or years with disabilities. And that's why tonight we need to talk about living a long life is going to require more than just good luck. You know what's good about the good old days? Not a whole lot if you happened to got sick. Heart attack, stroke, cancer, your chances of survival back then in the good old days are a lot less than they are today. Our doctors are getting smarter, our medicine's getting better, and our research and development is much farther than has ever been before. But again, with additional years, we don't know if they're going to be good years or years with disabilities. There might be a point in our lives where we might need some assistance, and that help might come from a spouse or a family member. But as our condition might get worse, outside help might be necessary. So before I go any farther, I want to go over some definitions which are going to lead into the conversation about long-term care. And the first one is long-term care itself. What does it mean? It's generally described as providing care for a person or individual who is unable to perform one of the six activities of daily living. That's toileting, bathing, dressing, eating, transferring, and continence. It's primary custodial care and not skilled care. We need to know what the difference is between the two. Skilled care is a type of care that is so complicated that it's usually administered by a doctor and executed by a skilled nurse or the doctor himself. Examples might be dialysis, surgical procedures, doctor's visits, and so forth. Just the opposite would be custodial care. Custodial care is the type of care which you might need help in performing one of the six activities of daily living mentioned in the last slide. Example might be, you might need help in the morning waking up, getting ready for your day, getting out of bed, showering, cooking, and so forth. You know, a lot of people, they think about when they're getting, if they eventually need long-term care, it's an individual concern. It's not. It's a family concern. See, when a child has to take care of a parent without support services outside the family to help them, it affects their lives, affects their family life. If they have to take a parent to the doctors or the hospital and call out of work or leave work early, they might miss out on promotions or career advancements. They might be missing out on their daughter's school play or missing their son's soccer game. But will they take care of a parent? Of course they will. Why? They love you. Simply, it's the right thing to do. Every day you go to your mailbox, probably at least once a week, you get solicited for a long-term care insurance company. Being an agent, the company itself, now the states are sending stuff out to make you aware. And there's an old statistic always used, and it really annoys me. I want to educate you today what they really mean by it, because they use it to scare you. They use it to scare you to buy a product. And that statistic is, once I reach the age 65, I have 43% chance of going to a nursing home. Okay? But today, we're going to understand what that statistic really means. We're going to break it down. What they're really saying is, once I reach the age of 65, I have a 43% chance of spending some time in a nursing home. In reality, between age 65 and 74, you have less than 1% chance of passing away in a nursing home. Between 75 and 84, 6%. And I'm sure if I had the statistics and I looked beyond 84, I'm sure the percentage is higher. Okay, so what do they mean that, spend some time? There's a chance that you could go to the hospital, have a procedure done, and the doctor prescribes a rehabilitation program. And that program might be done in a nursing institution, which will constitute spending some time in a nursing home. But I don't want to confuse you tonight of not needing care. The difference is, there's a good chance that the care is going to be administered in your house or in your community. So again, just because you may not be going to a nursing home does not mean you may not need care. It's going to be done in the community so your family members, like your children, can still offer to help without sacrificing their family time and their careers because they'll have outside services to chip in with the time while you're at work. I'm going to show you a little video because we all heard it before. I got to play with the remote a little bit to get it working. It takes just a couple seconds to start. Hopefully I won't blast it.
Hospital costs have risen by more than 200% since 1965. to an average cost of $128 per day. If you have to stay in a hospital or a nursing home or under doctor's care for a very, very long time, it puts an incredible strain on your lifetime savings and on your peace of mind.
Health care has gone up since 1960, 1,000%. The cost of health care for a given level of treatment is doubling every 5 years.
All of us have family, friends, or neighbors who have suffered devastating illnesses that threaten their financial security. For too long, older Americans in particular have faced the possibility of sicknesses that might not only wipe out their own savings, but those of their families.
It used to be that going to the hospital didn't conjure up visions of financial suicide.
Sometimes I have to be reminded that we have heard it before. But today, we're going to find out how we're going to pay for that care. And I'm going to talk about four different funding options today. I'm going to talk first about Medicare, then about Medicaid, to pay for it myself, I got the money, and the last, long-term care insurance. First off, let's understand what Medicare is. Medicare is health insurance, okay? Health insurance pays for skilled care, not custodial care. So if we were to stay at home, we would only pay for skilled care, not custodial care. If we were to go to adult daycare, it would not pay. Will not pay for assisted living. And it will pay up to 100 days in a nursing home. Part of those days will have a copay. And there are requirements for how many days you have to stay in a hospital to qualify for that. The next one I think is really important to touch on is Medicaid. There's a lot of misconceptions what Medicaid is. I hear so many people talk about, they think they have Medicaid when they're really talking about Medicare and vice versa, and they really don't understand what it is. So I'm going to make it really simple. Medicaid's a welfare program. It's a federal welfare program administered by the states. Okay? It is not an entitlement program. It's not like Medicare where you work and you're qualified to receive Medicare when you retire at a particular age. It's a welfare program. It means you have to be in poverty. There are spend down limits to qualify for it. But let's figure out what it pays for. For home care, they'll pay for skilled care. Adult daycare, very limited. Assisted living facility, very little. But it will pay for a nursing home. Okay? A lot of times I hear clients talk about, they'll say, I heard from a coworker, I heard a lawyer talk once, or one of my friends told me, if I ever had to go to a nursing home, I'll just transfer my assets. And then I'll have Medicaid pay for it. Okay, first off, what you're telling me is you're planning to go to the one place you don't want to be at. Okay? So I'll transfer my assets, and God forbid you transfer to your children, and then your spouse has to ask for the money back. You're not going to see it. All right? So I'm going to transfer my assets, qualify for the 3-year look-back period, so I can go to the one place I don't want to be at. I don't know about you, but I'd rather have my care administered at home, an assisted living facility, or adult daycare in the community where my child can help with my care if he wants to. Next one is, pay for it myself. I worked my whole life. I saved. I got an IRA. I got my own personal savings. I have enough money to pay for my care if I get sick. Okay. I've reviewed many financial plans, ones I prepared, other people's prepared, and I've never in my life seen the what if category, what if I get sick plan. No one has a separate pool of money set aside, $300,000, $500,000. If I get sick and I have to go to a nursing home, this money is going to be used. Usually they'll say, they'll come out of my retirement savings. Okay? I'm going to pick on the men. God forbid you're in a nursing home and your wife's at home at the kitchen table writing that check every month, $6,000 to $12,000 for a semi-private room in a facility to pay for your care. How many months of paying that check before her stomach turns because she's thinking one or two things? She's thinking, oh my God, I'm going to outlive our savings. Or two, she's thinking, what's going to pay for my care if I get sick? So in reality, your retirement portfolio, probably one of your largest assets you hold, is really exposed to your largest risk. And that risk is going to be that you're going to live a long life. And when you live a long life, you have a chance of getting sick. And when you get sick, you need care, and that care costs money. We're all used to paying for insurance. We drive a car, we have automobile insurance. We live in a house, we buy homeowners insurance. While we have children in our household, we buy life insurance. While we work, we protect our income with disability insurance. If we want to leave a larger estate, we buy additional life insurance. But there's nothing there right now protecting our largest asset, and that's our retirement portfolio. Long-term care insurance can actually fill that gap. See, unlike your Medicare, your Medigap policies, or other health insurance programs, long-term care insurance will pay for that custodial care. It'll allow you to stay in your home as long as possible receiving that care. It'll allow you to go to adult daycare or assisted living facility. It'll allow your children to help support your care and have that help from outside services. It'll also pay, God forbid, if you need to go to a nursing home. It allows your retirement portfolio to do what you intended to do. When you sat down with your financial advisor, when you sat down and did your retirement budget, it allows to do what it intended to do, and that's to supply you and your spouse an income for the rest of your lives. If you decide that you want to look and shop for long-term care insurance, I'm going to give you some recommendations. First off, if you're sitting across, hopefully you're sitting across from me, but if you're not, and you're sitting across someone else, and you feel at any moment that they're trying to shove a product down your throat to buy, get out. This is not your car insurance or an umbrella policy which could be sold in 15 minutes. There's a reason why you cannot go to an insurance company directly through a website and buy it yourself. It's a complicated product, and the average person doesn't understand it. So they force you to go through an agent. You want to make sure that the person can understand your needs, your financial needs, and how to structure the policy. Maybe you want your advisor to work with your attorney to figure out the best way to build the policy to protect your assets. The next thing you want to do is you want to make sure that agent can represent many different insurance carriers. A lot of clients, they might have their insurance at Allstate, they might have their insurance at Met, and they sit down and talk to their insurance agent, because those are the same people you sat with when you talk about your homeowners and your umbrella policies, and you got solicited to come in and sit about long-term care insurance. They can only sell one product. That's their product. They're a captive agent. And there's a reason why you want to work with an agent who represents many carriers. First is price. It's a big, vast price difference between policies, which I'll show you on the next slide. Second is your underwriting criteria. And I'm going to give you an example of one of my clients I got referred. One of my clients referred me a client, and the reason why she came to me, she got declined. The client had double knee replacement. And they went to a captain agent, and if anyone ever applied for long-term care, they know it's about 2 to 3 month waiting period from the day you did the application to issue. But after 2 months, they got declined, and they didn't know why. The agent called them and said, sorry, you got declined, and the client had to write a letter because of HIPAA regulations. We don't know the reason why. And 2 weeks later, they got the reason that double knee replacement's the reason. And the insurance company would have wrote them if they waited 2 years from the surgery. So she's telling this to my client, and she's going, well, you know what? We got long-term care insurance, and my husband had heart surgery, had a bypass surgery, had a stent put in, and my agent got us insured no problem. Double knee surgery doesn't sound as bad. So she said, why don't you go talk to my guy? His name is Rich. So the client came in. We sat down. And we waited 1 month from the time we met. I had an insurance company which had a 6 month waiting period, not 2 years. And not only did the client get issued, they got issued preferred. Okay? But one insurance company looks at it as a negative, another one can look positively on it. This insurance company said double knee replacement, that adds 20 years on your knees. Why not give them a preferred rating? The other thing you have to be concerned about, if you ever get declined or rated by an insurance company for long-term care, other companies will not even write it. On every application, there's a question, have you been declined or rated? There's a cost for an insurance company to start the underwriting process of every single application. They have to send a notice to your doctor, send the medical results to them, what we call APSs, and that costs, the doctors charge money for that. So some insurance companies say, well, if you've been rated before or declined by another insurance company, we're not even going to start the process. So you don't want to, work with someone who has the ability to place you in many different insurance carriers. I know the screen's really, really hard to see, But what I want to show is I have four different insurance carriers up there for a 58-year-old male preferred who's married. Okay? And the first column says GE. Next column says John Hancock. Third column's Met, and the fourth one is Allianz. We can skip out the two. We'll just see what the ends. If we were looking at just these policies are pretty much structured the same without adding additional riders. Okay? If we were just looking at this as the average consumer, we would just, these are all great credit ratings, all good insurance companies. We would look at the bottom price, which says $1,900. Okay? Compared to the GE, which I can't even see that close, it's basically 20, I'm rounding up, $2,200. We would jump with Allianz. It's got great credit rating, cheaper price, go with them. You know, everything else looks the same. But if you really look into the policy, there are differences. I'll give you an example. The GE is a monthly benefit. That may not make sense to anyone. 5% compound while on claim, not just 5% compounding when you're not on claim. 0-day elimination for home care. So these are benefits you might be willing to pay for. And then just the opposite, you might be in a situation where those benefits aren't necessary and we would want to save the money. But you should be educated as consumers to know what the differences are between the two policies. And that's why there is a price difference. This is an annual premium. I'm sorry, this particular policy? It's a 5-year benefit period. If anyone doesn't know what this stuff means, 5-year benefit period, 5% compound, 90-day elimination, spousal discount, and this particular one's a monthly benefit. It's built in, it's monthly.
And how much is the monthly benefit? How many
bucks? Do you know the Jersey monthly and daily? This is a $6,000 monthly benefit. What I'm describing is there's a term called daily benefit amount. If anyone looked at long-term care insurance, it was always daily. What that meant was if you had a $100 bill that day, your insurance company paid the $100. But if your policy said 2 and your bill was 3, we'd only pay the $200. So what insurance companies do is instead of doing daily benefit, they went to a monthly benefit, so they averaged the whole month out and they credit you the $6,000 for the month. I'll give you an example on a daily. You have a $200 daily benefit. First day it costs you $100. They paid the $100. Next day they didn't pay anything. They didn't pay anything. Next day, your cost was $300. The insurance company only pays the $200. If you had a monthly benefit, it would all be paid for. They would average it out.
Because it's 5 years benefit period, that means once you start having the benefit, getting the benefit, and then 5 years.
Okay. What the benefit period means is how long the insurance company is on the hook for paying the policy. Now, it's a pool of money, okay? If in the ideal situation, if it was $200 a day for they paid out for 5 years, it would be over. But let's use an example. Let's say they only paid $100 a day for 5 years. You would actually have a 10-year benefit period. We use the benefit period to calculate the benefit dollars amounts. And I'm just using 5 years as an example. There are cases if Alzheimer's runs in the family, I might recommend a longer time period. If it doesn't, I don't recommend lifetime. So each case is individually planned, each policy I build. Any other questions? Sir?
What's the prevalence of organizations, companies providing this benefit to their employees or to their executives for that matter?
Okay.
What are some of the tax implications of that?
Each type of entity has a different tax break to it. The ideal one is you have a C corporation and the company's paying for it, it's 100% tax deductible. There's a form if you write your name and address or request. If you say, Rich, can you send me the tax information? I have a brochure describing all of them. Individuals, it's limited to your Schedule A at 7.5%. Your medical costs is limited to 7.5%, and then after that, it's deductible on your Schedule A. Group benefits, though, I think you were leading into?
Well, I was referring to both group, what's prevalence of companies, you know, adopting plans, either for all of their employees or for their people.
Okay. A lot of, there's different types of employer-sponsored programs. There are some guaranteed issue plans, so doesn't make a difference how what your medical conditions are. They have to issue. A lot of bigger corporations qualify for that. That could be a pro and that could be a con. See, if you're healthy and you go into a group plan, they're probably rating you as a standard. And you might be better off going on your own to get your own policy. But if you're standard or substandard with a guaranteed issue, you're better off going through your company plan then. All right. There's other plans where they don't give a guaranteed issue, but they'll give a discount. MetLife, John Hancock, they give a 5% to group plans or employer-sponsored plans. Lincoln Benefit, which is getting out of the business next, which is Allstate, getting out of the business next month, but they used to give a 10% discount.
I'm sorry, who's getting out of business?
Allstate is. They have a product under Lincoln Benefit, which is a subsidiary of their company. As of end of October, they will not be writing long-term care insurance. But they will honor all the policies they've issued.
But Lincoln Benefit will?
They'll, Lincoln Benefit, which is Allstate.
Oh.
They're going to stop selling new policies, but they will honor all the policies they've issued in the past.
Even?
Why? Unless you really are serious in the long-term care business and you have enough policies on the books, you can't make it. I mean, if you don't have a lot of insurance on the book, long-term care, you need enough premiums received to pay out too.
Exactly.
GE's the largest, that John Hancock, MetLife's really big, physicians, these are big companies who are serious into the business. Has anybody ever heard of CNA?
Yeah.
They used to be humongous in long-term care insurance. They don't write they don't write any policies anymore. And anyone who's owned their policy probably experienced a 50% increase in their premiums.
So you could buy a policy today, 5 years.
What happens is they cannot guarantee premiums. The states will not allow them to do that. So what the insurance companies who are serious into the business, what they do is they stop selling an old product. They issue a new product to new policyholders at a higher rate. So the people who bought it previously don't have a rate increase, but the new people buying it do. Because if you can imagine you're retired on a fixed income and you have a $2,000 long-term care bill, double that for your spouse, $4,000, now I'm telling you that you have a 20% increase, that's going to hurt people who are on fixed incomes. So these insurance companies spend millions of dollars in advertising to build their name. They're not going to want to raise premiums on existing policyholders only to tarnish their name. As soon as they do, it's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Trust me. Any other questions?